KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kabu.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Welcome to Labor Radio. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm L.A. Gilland.
Thank you so much for joining us. We got a great show for you today, but just quickly, I'd like to give a quick reminder that this is the last week of KABU's spring membership drive. We only have a few days left to reach our goal of $60,000. So please help us get there. If you can, donate today at kabu.fm/give. Or if you're interested in using the KABU mobile app, just click on the donate button on the app. And please help us again support community-powered radio. And also, we'd just like to give a special thanks and shout out to the Labor Radio Podcast Network for hosting podcasted versions of our show each month. So be sure to check that out at laborradionetwork.org. So today we're going to be discussing the minimum wage in this country, and you know, give a little bit of history about it, and then discuss it in our contemporary time. And you know, obviously, it is a topic that is being discussed heavily, both, you know, in the political, you know, in Congress, but also in workplaces around the country. So I'd just like to read a quick quote from Franklin Delano Roosevelt discussing minimum wage and living wage. In 1933, FDR said, "It seems to me to be plain that no business which depends for existence on paying less than living wages to its workers has any right to continue in this country. By business, I mean the whole of commerce, as well as the whole of industry. By workers, I mean all workers, the white-collar class, as well as the workers in overalls. By living wages, I mean more than a bare subsistence level. I mean wages of decent living." And so, you know, just to go back and discuss the history of where the minimum wage in this country comes from, that president right there, FDR, was in fact the one who pushed for it and included it as part of the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. The FLSA, the Fair Labor Standards Act, aimed to eliminate sweatshop conditions by establishing a minimum wage, a maximum work week, and outlawing child labor. All things that we, you know, take for granted now, you know, child labor and having a 40-hour work week, those were things that were not established at that time, and so it did require an act of Congress to...
Yeah, and things that, you know, that we talked a lot about, like the gig economy can quickly, you kind of turn on its head because, you know, what is a worker, all these types of things. Like,
exactly.
This is all really connected to everything we've been talking about for the last couple months.
Yeah, it's actually a really good point. Yeah, I mean, like, basically, this discussion topic that we've had ongoing for a few months being, you know, the gigification of our economy, this is basically the revolt against what, you know, the implementation of these standards. And yeah, so now we're seeing with things like Proposition 22, the attempt to basically completely work around the things like the Fair Labor Standards Act in order to eliminate the employer-employee relationship. This is an ongoing topic of discussion on this show, but obviously minimum wage is a topic that, even if there is a movement to pass $15 an hour at a federal level, it is still going to be something that is pushed back against by the expansion of Prop 22 style legislation in state houses around the country.
Yep.
To kind of give a little bit more history here, basically the FLSA and specifically adding the minimum wage provision in that was the first time that the U.S. government set a principle that Americans are entitled to at least a certain amount of pay for their work, which, again, is something we take for granted now, but there was no standard for what you could, the least that you could be paid prior to that. So this was a big provision of the New Deal, which itself was a massive shift in the balance of power from workers, from capital to workers. And so sort of evening the playing field, balancing out the playing field there. The New Deal set out to do that in a lot of ways, but the FLSA and specifically the minimum wage was something that really does hold over into our current economy now. Initially, the minimum wage was set at 25 cents an hour. President Roosevelt had argued for it to be 40 cents an hour, but had to negotiate back from that down to 25 cents in order to win approval from Southern lawmakers. There's a lot of other things that went into that debate, including the pretty racist exclusion of farm workers in order to appeal to Southern Democrats there's a lot that we can go into there. But just to keep moving forward, the federal minimum wage applies to workers employed by companies with revenues of at least $500,000 annually, plus workers in hospitals, nursing homes, schools, government agencies, and those who are involved in interstate commerce, which would seem to apply to most, at this point, most companies that operate in our economy here. It has, over the history of its existence, it has been raised 22 times by 12 different presidents. Mm-hmm. The raising of the minimum wage is probably the biggest controversy around that surrounds the concept of a minimum wage ever since it was implemented. There's, obviously arguments back and forth about what could happen if you raise the wage, the fallout from that, and also the arguments in favor of why the wage needs to be raised in order to keep up with cost of living. There was no implementation, when the minimum wage was implemented, there was no element that allowed it to continue rising with the inflation or with the cost of living. So that continues to be a problem that surrounds it. In 1968, the federal minimum wage peaked in its purchasing power at $1.60 per hour, which in 2019 dollars was the equivalent of $11.53. And then since 1968, the minimum wage has failed to keep up with rising inflation. It peaked at its purchasing power nearly 60 years ago.
Yeah.
Actually, more than that. In 2009, the federal minimum wage was raised to its current rate of $7.25 an hour. And since then, in 2016, both New York and California passed laws raising the wage to $15 an hour as a gradual phase-in. And as of 2019, 29 states and the District of Columbia maintained higher minimum wages than the federal standard. And that includes 8 states that automatically increase the wage based on cost of living, which is a great addition to it because, if you take, and we'll discuss this further, but the concept of raising the wage is a thing that gets debated and discussed in political corridors for a long time. By the time you actually raise it, the effective rate that you raise it to may, because of inflation, may end up being far less than where it was, argued to be when the debate started.
Mm-hmm.
Those are some basic facts about it. A lot of people in this country have probably either worked for the minimum wage or know someone who does work for that. There is basically no city in this country where someone earning the minimum wage can afford to live, in a one-bedroom apartment.
Yeah.
At this point, it's pretty clear that is not a living wage. You can't afford a place to live while earning that wage.
Yeah, and I think we'll probably touch on it, but, more and more studies are showing that, a lot of the rhetoric around this stuff is that, nobody, stays at a fast food place forever.
Right.
The minimum wage is meant for someone who's, 18 or something, in high school or something like that. And we're just seeing in the data that that's just not the case. People are sticking with these jobs for their whole lives or huge portions of their life. And so it really affects a lot of people kind of who need a higher level of purchasing power.
Exactly. And, you know, especially now, I mean, obviously this has been true in our economy since the crash of 2008 and prior to that, but it has really become exacerbated in this moment, the pandemic moment, where a lot of jobs were lost and kind of the biggest growth sector of our economy is the service sector, you know, is the frontline workers, is the folks who do a lot of the, you know, the basic work of keeping our society flowing and working, but also those jobs tend to be valued less by us as a society and therefore tend to be low-wage working jobs. And so, you know, not everyone working in those positions makes minimum wage, but they often make close to minimum wage. And so raising the wage would be important to, you know, bring the level, the pay level of any job that is, you know, in that range around the minimum wage and rise that. So, you know, obviously we're discussing here, you know, the fact that it has not been raised, why the minimum wage hasn't been raised in, you know, over a decade. And, you know, it's often cited by folks who talk about wanting to raise the wage that if the minimum wage had increased based on the rate of productivity since 1960, it would be about $23 or $24 an hour right now instead of $7.25 an hour, which is a huge contrast. And, you know, whereas $7.25 is effectively a poverty wage in basically every county in this country, $23 to $24 an hour would actually be a living wage in most cities in this country.
So
on top of that, the federal minimum wage for tipped workers is only $2.13 an hour, which means that if you work in a restaurant or any type of, you know, environment where you are going to receive tips and you do rely on tips, then they can, your employer can effectively pay you less than the minimum wage and assume that that will be made up by the generosity of your customers. And, you know, again...
Which is crazy as well because, you know, a lot of that work was considered essential.
Right.
So, like, we leaned on these folks basically during the pandemic and then, it's got a little backwards.
Exactly. And then, you know, even on top of that, like, in this pandemic period where just restaurants have had to close or, like, the way that restaurants operate has changed, you know, there's so few people or just far fewer people dining in or eating at a place where they might actually then tip the server. And far more people just taking out or ordering through apps. So the tips don't actually make their way to the restaurant workers, or if they do, they're far less than what they, you know, the rate that they were expecting. And yet those workers are still getting, you know, the employers still are allowed to pay them well below minimum wage, even though the tips have diminished. So that is a discussion that I don't think has really grasped the public imagination yet. But I think absolutely needs to be a part of the concept of raising the minimum wage, is discussing eliminating, you know, lower wages, you know, the tip provision for lower wages. So obviously, you know, we've touched on it a bit here, but there has been a campaign going for, you know, almost a decade now to raise the minimum wage, specifically to raise it to $15 an hour, which, you know, would more than double the current federal minimum wage and would raise roughly 30 million workers, you know, give roughly 30 million workers a raise. Now, of course, as we mentioned before, the fact that this campaign started in 2012 means that in the decade that this has been discussed, the value of that $15 has diminished considerably. And if it were to be, you know, if the Raise the Wage Act were to be implemented, it would still take a five-year phase-in. So if it were to be passed, you know, in the next year, it would still not be implemented up to $15 for another 5 years, which by then the value of $15 would be even farther diminished.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe it's time to start talking about like a $20 minimum wage or something like that. But, you know, baby steps. We're going one step at a time here. And so, yeah, obviously if you've ever, you know, had heard this discussion or even just worked in a service environment or a lower paying environment, I'm sure you've heard the arguments for and against raising the minimum wage. You know, the most common arguments against raising it are that business owners would either need to raise prices or fire workers, or, you know, sometimes it's argued that they need to do both. That, of course, has not been borne out by the data around areas that have raised minimum wage. And, you know, just like a simple way to think about it is the fact that, like, if it were true that raising the wage would need to would necessarily mean that prices would have to rise, then how come it is that basically the cost of everything else in our society, since the federal minimum wage of $7.25 was implemented over a decade ago, how come the cost of everything else in our society has been raised or has increased, and yet the wages have stayed stagnant?
Yeah.
You know, if it were that only the only reason that the cost of things would go up is because you had to pay workers more, then how come it is that things have still been, you know, the price of things has still gone up, and yet workers are being paid the same wage they were a decade plus ago?
Yeah, doesn't make any sense.
Not at all. And so that really does kind of negate that. There's a lot of other arguments that can be made to combat that concern, but I think that's the most simple way to think about it. Another argument that is made pretty consistently is that, you know, from folks who may earn well over a $15 an hour wage, is that, well, if, you know, the wage goes up, then those workers, you know, the low wage workers will be earning as much as I do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that wouldn't be fair to me, who's someone who's working in a white collar job, or, you know, who may have had more education or may have been in the job longer. You know, how come a teenager at a fast food joint would be earning the same as I do in this office? And I think the pretty clear response to that is then, well, yeah, you're right, they would be earning that. And therefore, you could go to your boss and say, well, I need a raise, otherwise I'm going to go get a much easier job working at, you know, a restaurant and earn the same wage.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it really does point to the fact that a rising tide lifts all boats.
Yeah.
And I think that's the best argument in favor.
And the livable wage is still being paid for, right?
Right.
These businesses are just having the government do it for them.
Exactly.
Right? So, like, all of these things, these people are just ending up on food stamps or things of this nature. So it's not like the money is not being spent. It's just being spent by the federal government.
Yeah, exactly. The companies are internalizing the profit of it and externalizing the cost onto the taxpayer. I mean, exactly like you said, I mean, a place like Walmart, you know, when you get hired at places like that, they oftentimes, in your new hire packet, will provide you with application for food stamps.
Yeah.
Because they know they aren't paying you anywhere near living wage, and therefore they say, hey, just go to the government and get your handout from them, and we won't take care of you at all here. We'll just help you get money from the government. And so, yeah, I think, you know, that's the other side of it, of this discussion, that just really doesn't ever get touched on in the national media. But that really is, you know, very much... these companies are welfare companies that, you know, don't want to discuss it that way. But
we've done it on the show, but I mean, a lot of modern capitalism is this way.
Exactly.
So
no, that's 100% right. Like, basically, the state of play for most big businesses in this country is to internalize the profit of things and externalize the cost onto the taxpayer, or onto the public, or onto, you know, the government. And so this is no different from that. And, you know, another. As Elliot mentioned earlier, another major argument against why the minimum wage should be raised is saying that really it's just a wage, like a starting wage for kids, for teenagers who are working in high school. It's like a part-time job.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, that is not anywhere near reality. Essential workers make up about half of all the workers in the lowest paid occupations, and about 8% of people working in hospitality and leisure earn federal minimum wage or lower. And, you know, so if you look at the demographics of that group, it's about, you know, a little over half of all the people earning the minimum wage are over the age of 26 years old. And if you look at, like, the demographic breakdown, a lot of them are people who are single parents, who have children, who are supporting a family on that wage. And only about 0.1% of workers making the minimum wage in the U.S. can afford to buy a one-bedroom apartment. So, again, you know, if you're talking about people who are... well into, you know, their prime working years, or have children or are supporting families, and they can't even afford a one-bedroom apartment, then, you know, that the whole demographics argument goes right out the window with that. And so, again, these are just the main arguments against it. And if you look back through, you know, history, you know, going all the way back to 1937 when the FLSA was first being debated, these are basically the same arguments that are just being recycled time and time again against why the minimum wage should not, you know, back then it was why it shouldn't exist, and now it has been, they've been rolled out time and again to combat why it should never be raised. And so, you know, at a certain point, if these are the same arguments that people were making, you know, before World War II, I think that they probably need to be retired, and the whole situation needs to be reevaluated. Now, of course, there are some employers in the, you know, the service sector and in the lower wage area, in lower wage industries, that are doing the right thing. Places like In-N-Out or Dick's Burgers up in Seattle, they offer $17 an hour starting wages, and Dick's even offers health insurance with that. And as you know, if you've ever eaten at either of those places, you know that their prices are not any higher than McDonald's or anywhere like that. So they are, you know, obviously bucking the trend, and they're proving that it is possible to provide a real living for your workers and also continue to keep prices low and attract customers. Mm-hmm. I mean, In-N-Out is one of the most celebrated burger chains in the entire country, and Dick's is beloved by everyone, you know, in the state of Washington. So mm-hmm. I think that pretty much negates that argument right there. And, you know, just to take a quick break and to reintroduce anyone who might just be tuning in right now, this is Labor Radio, and we are discussing the minimum wage, and we have been covering sort of the arguments against, or, you know, why we've been combating the arguments against why it should not be raised and discussing a little bit of the history. And we are now going to turn to discussing, you know, our current time and how the pandemic era has really changed the public imagination around this issue. But also, just quickly, if you're just joining us, we are in the final, the last week of KBOO's membership, spring membership drive, and we only have a few days left to reach our goal of $60,000. So if you can, please help us get there. You can go to right now to kboo.fm/give to donate, or if you're using the KBOO mobile app, just click on the donate button, and please, yes, help us support, help support our community power radio. So just jumping back in now to our discussion around the minimum wage and sort of our contemporary moment, where we saw in, you know, right around the beginning of the year and the beginning of the Biden administration, there was a push. I mean, Biden in his campaign, all throughout his presidential campaign, made raising the minimum wage to $15 a plank of his campaign, a top priority of his. And in fact, when the first COVID relief bill was put forward, that was actually a provision that was included in it. Now, of course, you know, political wonks know the whole story behind why that was eventually dropped. But essentially, it was determined that there was this, the Senate parliamentarian determined that it could not be, it was not relevant to the COVID relief bill, and therefore it did not need to be a part of it, and it would have to be reconciled through the reconciliation process. And senators, Democratic senators Manchin and Sinema both voted against it, so it was dropped from the bill. But that doesn't mean that it's not a thing that is still top of mind for, you know, more progressive Democrats and, you know, theoretically the Biden administration as well. So there is still a window over the next year and a half to try and push it back through Congress as a standalone bill. There is, I think I touched on it earlier, but there is the Raise the Wage Act. That is, it has been voted through Congress and is ready for the Senate to vote on, and that would raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. It would be a 5-year phase-in, but it would effectively get us there. You know, and it would start that conversation at least about raising it again. So there's that. There's of course also the PRO Act, which would help not only raise the minimum wage to $15, but also help strengthen unions and combat right-to-work laws and make it easier for workers to push for higher wages on their own as well. So those are all things that can be done and that are ostensibly supported by the current Democratic Party in power. So there is hope on the horizon that this may be something that is pushed forward within, you know, our lifetime, within the next couple of years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think everybody, you know, who's talking about this is not saying, you know, because another thing you hear all the time is, well, why stop at 15 then? Why not make it 30? You know, and I think, you know, we want to listen to our economists and different things like that. And I know the minimum wage is a divisive topic among, you know, a lot of economists. But, you know, at a certain point, we're just not keeping up with the cost of living.
No.
So someone's paying for it. Is it the business or, you know, is it the federal government?
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, sure. The, you know, a contrarian would say, well, yeah, why stop there? Why not raise it to $30 an hour? And it's like, well, of course, you know, that is not, no one's arguing for that right now. But as Elliot just said, yeah, like there is a cost associated with continuing to pay workers so little and expecting so much from them. And I think that that, you know, as we're seeing in this moment, there's only so much that workers will take before there's a breaking point. And that sort of gets to the next section that I'd really like to dive into, which is kind of the worker revolt that we're seeing in this moment, especially like essential workers. I mean, if you've been anywhere on the internet or if you've tried to go to a fast food restaurant in a lot of places around this country, you may have come across signs out front that are basically, you know, either from the employer saying like, you know, please excuse, like, please be patient with us. We are having trouble hiring and we don't have enough, you know, no one here wants to work. Or, you know, conversely, signs from fed up employees saying like, hey, customers, please understand, we are not working here anymore because they refuse to pay us a living wage.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, obviously this has been boiling for a long time, but in the pandemic moment, there has been kind of a tipping point in this discussion where there is the unemployment benefits that are extended through the COVID relief bill that are by no means, you know, allowing anyone to live large, but are at least providing a bit of income for folks who have lost their jobs that allows them to exist, you know, and subsist at a level that is not below the poverty line. Mm-hmm. And so that is kind of opening a lot of people's eyes to the fact that, like, hey, why would I go into work and work, you know, at a job where I get yelled at by people and I, you know, get stressed out and may have to work crazy hours and be poor when I could stay home and still be poor but have time to figure out the next steps in my life and figure out like what I actually want to do in order to get myself into a better paying job. And so, you know, there really has been, in a lot of different ways, the pandemic has, I think, radicalized a lot of people, like a lot of workers in this country and people in general, to like the failed state of our economy and the overwhelming power that a very small number of corporations and individuals have. But I think that we're finally a year into it, seeing it play out on the other end, on the worker end. And so essential workers, you know, fast food workers, people like that, people who are basically kept our economy flowing, our society open and able to be fed and able to be taken care of through this very, you know, drastic year, are finally at their breaking point, and the balance of power is shifting in their direction, and I think the public is supporting that as well. Obviously there are a lot of there are a lot more steps that need to be taken in order to go from workers putting notes on the outside of their restaurants and to their, you know, to the clients or the customers, to actually then being organized in a union and able to demand the wages and the benefits they want. But, you know, at least we are at a point now where it seems like the confluence of the Democratic Party having you know, the PRO Act and the Raise the Wage Act in their sights, and workers understanding that they need to come together and they should be valued higher. Like, those two things, if they do meet, could actually lead to a shifting of the playing field and a balancing of power slightly more, you know, away from the basically like the 10 corporations that own more than 50% of the fast food brands in this country, towards, you know, so the working people who actually make those places profitable. So obviously that is something that is ongoing, and we will absolutely cover that as it continues to grow in our economy, as things continue to develop on that side of things. But just moving on slightly from that, recently President Biden, made a statement, you know, just because there has been so much pushback from employers about the unemployment benefits that are, you know, extended to people around the country because of COVID and how that has basically made people unwilling to work. And so he came out and said something to the effect of, let's see if I can find the exact quote here. Biden declared that anyone on unemployment benefits who is offered a, quote, suitable job must take the job or lose their unemployment insurance benefits. Mm-hmm. Now, he did not define suitable, and what suitable means, who gets to define that is a big part of this, I think. But what that means is essentially the pressure of business owners, you know, the outcry from business owners about not being able to find workers, adequate staff, has trickled up and has, you know, been heard by lawmakers to the point where there is definitely a chance that the UI benefits, the unemployment insurance benefits, may be phased out or, you know, may be under threat. If there is another COVID bill, they may not exist in that. Mm-hmm. Now, there are stories of places like McDonald's offering people $50 to come in for an interview, and then if the person chooses not to take that job, then they immediately report them to the employment office, and their benefit, you know, and so the unemployment folks find out, like, hey, they were offered a job, you know, it's quote unquote suitable, therefore we're yanking their unemployment benefits. So that person may have gone in and realized, hey, I don't want to work for the low wage that they're offering me at McDonald's. Yeah. I'm going to take this money.
Or in certain cases, like part-time, exactly, where, like, you know, you actually end up making less because you lose your benefits and you don't actually get full hours.
Yeah. And so, like, you know, someone would walk in and go, like, well, actually, this is not a good deal. I would rather continue receiving my benefits and figure out my next move at home than come here and slave away for this. But, you know, through the trickery, the company then reports you, narcs on you, and gets your unemployment benefits removed. So you basically are forced to go back and take that subpar job.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another area where I think, you know, we're going to see probably that propping up more and more within our economy. And I think that that'll fuel likely more of the workers, you know, wildcat striking and just individually choosing not to go into these jobs, and sort of get people more fed up about it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, all of this basically to say that this has further underscored the need for increased labor power in the job market, and that means that, of course, we need to get workers organized and into unions in order to tip the balance of power away from capital and towards workers. We need to put pressure on our lawmakers to make sure that the things like the PRO Act are passed, and you know, all of this is with